Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight was born in 1918 in Birmingham, England, and is a one-man celebration of 20th century American music. He counted Judy Garland, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, and Frank Sinatra as close friends. During World War II, he was a pilot for the Royal Air Force and the U.S. Army Air Force. He was the music director for NBC Television and is the founder of the New York Pops. His name, Skitch Henderson, and we're honored to have him as our guest. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now, back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with the maestro, Skitch Henderson. Skitch, welcome. It's an honor.
Thank you, Jack. It's a pleasure for me to be on this station after all these years.
Can you talk about your childhood and your parents?
Well, my father was in the export-import business. He traveled the world, and I went with him a couple of times when I was very, very young, but I don't recall that totally. My mother was a church organist and also worked in the theater. As I recall, she played in the pits, in the pit, as we say, you know, played piano, and was the one that really started me with my so-called music education. She was the strongest imprint on my life as far as music is concerned.
Your mom died when you were 10?
Yes, yeah. And my father, I don't think, had togetherness with me, is that what you say? And he sent me to live with an aunt, with his sister, who was my aunt, of course, who lived in, of all places, a little town called Halstead, Minnesota, which is in the Red River Valley. And I wasn't ecstatic with joy. I was there. I probably wasn't a good child, or whatever the word would be. And after a couple of years, I started running away, and eventually I succeeded in disappearing from her life completely.
A lot of young people have tough beginnings, and they say, I can't make anything of myself. What do you say to them, Skitch?
Well, I say that anything, of course, these were different times. See, in the 30s, it was so close to what had been, of course, the horrible Depression years, that existence meant a lot, no matter what your age factor. And I think a person 12, 14, 15 years old, they sometimes lose their way, and I, because of the difficulty of the times probably, and just the manner of being fed and trying to keep your fanny covered and stay with life, as it were, kept you more positive than the kids today. But any young person that's listening, I just say, put your house in order, don't give up, and try to be a general of your own life. Don't take advice from people, which I've always done, but then do it yourself. Do it yourself.
What instruments did you play?
Piano. My mother was, as I said, was a pianist and organist, and piano was my major instrument, and I alternately, it fed me, actually, when I started this life of indecision running around on the road. I found out that I could go to a cafe, or at that time, a lot of restaurants had a piano in the corner, and I could play Liebestraum or something like that and get fed. So that was really my password, as it were, to aesthetic culture and also gastronomic culture.
It's 1937. You're in Denver.
Yeah.
And you get an unexpected call. Can you tell us about that?
I'm playing in a rinky-dink band in Denver, in the hotel there, and a call came from a gentleman who was, as we say today, a road manager, old-fashioned road manager. His name was Frank Perquette. I'll never, ever forget him because of how it changed my life. He was on the road with two young people from MGM called, the man was Mickey Yule and the lady was Judy Gum of the Gum Sisters. She became Judy Garland and he became Mickey Rooney. His dad was Joe Yule, who was a burlesque comic. And they were on the road extolling the virtues of MGM, which owned a great many of the theaters at that time. The studios used to own the theaters. And when they played Denver, their second date out on the train, their pianist became ill, very ill, and had to be either, I don't know, well, he had to be sent back. He could not continue the tour. And the theater manager said, there's a kid plays piano in the band. The only recommendation he gave was that I read music. And I joined them, went down and auditioned and joined them, and that was really the start of my life.
How did you get to Hollywood?
When the tour was over, we ended up in Chicago, and there was a ticket for the man that I had replaced. And Mr. Perquette said something like, kid, what are you going to do? And I said, I have no idea. He said, why don't you get on the train? I have a ticket here for you. So with no brains, with very little money, but with a new sweater and new slacks, I got on the train and went to Hollywood.
Sketch, where did you get the courage, the audacity to do these things?
I don't know. I think there must be some squirrel in your skull if you have any kind of an aesthetic brain. Maybe, I don't know whether it works in financial brains or not, but if you have an aesthetic brain, so many people that are performers come from strange backgrounds and strange lives. There must be some little peapod in your skull that keeps you going and makes you think that you're going to make it somehow.
When we come back, we'll talk to Sketch about some of the entertainers, the greatest entertainers that he ever worked with. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Sketch Henderson, the founder of the New York Pops. Sketch, you've worked with thousands of entertainers. Who was the greatest?
Well, I think the man that, I don't know that I admired him the most, but I was in awe of him, was, of all people, Maurice Chevalier. Everybody talked about Jolson, and I once did a benefit with him after World War II, but I didn't know his act, and he was not too friendly towards me trying to play piano for him. But Chevalier was, to me, just absolutely a magnet on the stage. If there's anybody, I felt with all kinds of people from all walks of life. I mean, he related to everybody. And I think I would put him, when I met my wife, Ruth Henderson, Ruth Einsiedel, a good German lady, that we were at the Plaza one night, and we weren't married as yet, but there had been an announcement in the local press here in New York that possible that we were going to be married. Chevalier got up from a table across from us in the old Oak Room at the Plaza. I walked over to Ruth, and he was a giant, you know, and he walked over to Ruth and said, you're marrying a nice man. And then he walked away, and I thought that was the greatest accolade I could have.
Who was the greatest American entertainer?
For me, Crosby. Now, there would be many arguments from a lot of people, but I looked at Crosby as something different because I looked at the spectrum of his thoughts about life, and not only as an entertainer, but his whole world, the way he talked to people, his love of orchestra players, so many different facets of Bing that never have been talked about too much. His total candor, his total honesty, his ability to give advice. When I was very young in the business and just starting to work in Hollywood, And I came into some dilemma of some kind that I talked to him about, and he said, always say yes and then walk away and do what you want. I thought that was great advice. And he said, you can do it then diplomatically and nobody will ever hammer on you. And I've used that most of my life.
How did you get your nickname, Skitch?
I was working at MGM as a rehearsal pianist. Not only MGM, my mom had given me really a very strong education, and I had the brains when I went to Hollywood to still keep working with various piano teachers and studying. And I would do lots of times the studio pianists might look upon something that one of the composers, Alfred Newman or Max Steiner, one of these people, had written that was extremely difficult, and I became the whiz kid that I could be called in, and I had such courage, I don't know why, but or stupidity, I guess, and I would walk in and just waffle through everything. But they called me the sketch kid because when the songwriters, principally people like Irving Berlin, Humans, Jerry Kern, people like that, would bring a score into the studio, I would sit in the corner. And they would do the auditions. They would audition their songs for the producer. And then I would sit in the corner, and I would transpose them to the right key for the artist for whom the song had been written. And I'd make a little sketch. It would be the first progress of what eventually was going to be on the screen. And Bing, they called me the Sketch Kid or CD. I hated that name. And my Christian name was Lyle Russell Cedric, so I, you know, ran away from everything. And once Crosby said to me, if you're going to compete, get your name straightened out. My name was Harry, and nobody ever heard of me in Spokane and later with the Whiteman Band. But when I became Bing, within a couple of weeks, everybody at Lindy's knew my name. And he nagged me till I changed my passport, even beginning with World War II. I flew under Skitch Henderson.
You've always had a style about you, how you dress with the scarves, the shawls. Where did that come from?
I really am not sure. I think that's fear of how you present yourself. That's to young people, too. Of course, today things are totally different because dress code is different. I always loved people like Cary Grant, who were immaculate dressers, and I just think when I had a couple of bob and could afford to do anything, I immediately went to tailors and tried to look neat and clean most of the time. And I think it probably helped me in some instances. I'm not sure.
You were around all of this hoopla and glory. Rudyard Kipling, one of his many great poems, If, goes, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, etc. Skitch, you've kept your head versus a Howard Hughes, a Michael Jackson. How did you do that?
Well, I think some of it is luck. I think a great deal of it is luck. I was lucky to work with, when I had troublesome times and was trying to make a living, I worked with wonderful people. Bing before the war and a friend after, I'm talking about World War II, Bing before World War II, and during the war he wrote me wonderful letters. And after the war, Sinatra had then emerged, and he rang me up very soon when I arrived back after I stumbled around France for a while after the war, and made it possible for me to work again. I think you have to have some luck. And if things go in a reasonable direction of support, and if you don't have anybody to worry about, I didn't have family to worry about, so I really had nobody to push me around in any way. I could go back to my pad, however non-subtle it might be, and think about what I was going to do next. And I think that was very important in my life. I was a loner for a long time. And in some ways, I think now it was an advantage.
You accompanied a young vocalist named Dolores Reed.
Dolores Reed was a was and is one of the most wonderful singers. Her name now is Dolores Hope, of course, Bob Hope's wife. She worked in a saloon in New York when Bob was doing Broadway. And when they came to Hollywood, and this was my formative years there, I somehow met her. I still don't know how we met. And she wanted somebody, she wanted to keep singing, not necessarily in a cafe, but just singing. She liked to just keep her act going, as it were, till success would invade their lives, as it did, of course, when Bob became such a movie star. And Dolores was and is one of my very, very best friends. And she was she had a voice of gold. In fact, in the last time that Rosie Clooney played the Rainbow and Stars here in New York, Dolores was on the bill with her, and it was a joy to hear her.
We're talking to Skitch Henderson. When we come back, we'll ask him about some of the presidents that he dealt with. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're with Skitch Henderson, who was given his nickname by Bing Crosby. Skitch, you've rubbed elbows. You've sat at the tables with President Truman right on through George W. Which one's most impressed you?
I suppose Harry Truman, because I was called to be host of a dinner that we gave him right after he left office. We did it at the Muehlbach Hotel in Kansas City because he made it possible for those of us who were members of what was called the Army Air Corps. He changed it to and made it the Air Force, made it a separate organization. And that was an epical night. I still have pictures of that, Stuart Symington. The men that were sitting in those chairs, I thought, what the hell am I doing here? But he had asked me to do it because I had known him at the White House. And I think I talked to him about the Missouri Waltz, which he played in A-flat, as I recall. And, of course, Margaret, his daughter, at that time was going to have a career, and I worked with her very often on local television here in New York. So I would say that Mr. Truman... George Bush Sr. is a friend simply because he's a Navy pilot. But outside of that, I've been a slave most of the time when I go to the White House. I'm a peasant.
During the Kennedy years, the Camelot years, what involvement did you have?
I was very, very seldom involved at that time. Bobby Kennedy was my wife's friend. And that seemed to be the relationship that we had. I was never close to Jack. I used to see him a lot because we had a summer house up between Plymouth and Buzzards Bay, and when they'd fly the helicopter from Boston Airport out to the Shangri-La of the Kennedys, they'd always fly low over our pond and wave at us. But it was really not a close affiliation with Jack Kennedy.
We're talking to Skitch Henderson, who loves machinery. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Skitch Henderson. During World War II, Skitch flew for both the Royal Air Force and, after becoming an American citizen, the United States Army Air Corps. Can you share some of your experiences in those years?
Well, the Royal Air Force, I flew in Africa. I flew Hurricanes. I didn't get to fly the sophisticated airplanes. The Lords, the young men of rank, flew the Spitfire, especially the Mark V, the Mark IX. And while I was flying in Africa, I went on leave to London during the Blitz, strangely enough. I don't know why I went to London, but I met Bing on the street. He was there doing a USO show, and he asked me rather succinctly what it was like, and I said, you know, it looked like it was the way to oblivion to me, and I wasn't probably too complimentary on my position. I loved to fly, but the gun carriage used to bother me, as it probably did a lot of people. And that night he was singing for a group of very heavy brass. He was first singing for the enlisted personnel, a USO show, I think he was touring. But then that night he was singing for some officers later at night, and he asked me to come and play a couple of tunes with him. And I said, well, number one, I'm a flying sergeant, you know, and RAF rank is rank is rank. I don't think they'll let me in. And he said, I remember him saying, if you don't go, I don't go. Anyway, I played a couple of songs for him. One was Moonburn. I'll remember that forever. And when we finished working, unbeknownst to me, he had been talking to these officers about getting me transferred. He was trying to get me transferred to the group that was doing carrying the supplies back and forth. But, of course, those were airline pilots with very high time. And then he tried to get me transferred to what was then the Eagle Squadron, which was a squadron of people from America, from Poland, Czechoslovakia, all the wild men that we had in the RAF that flew, that just wanted to be war people and enlisted early and wore both wings, the wings of their home country and the wings of RAF. And I really didn't know too much about it. I went back to Africa. And a couple of weeks later, my Batman, who was a Scotsman who retook me and armed my guns and took care of the airplane for me, said, you either screwed up or you're going to get a medal. And he said, I'm to send you back to London at once. I went back, and there were papers greeting me to transfer me to the American, to the Army Air, or the Army Air Corps. And it's strange things can happen in wartime. The only thing that didn't work is that the citizenship, I was on my way to becoming an American citizen, and that got snafu'd, so I was really a man without a country, and after the war I had a hell of a time proving who I was and where I lived, and proving that I'd lived in Minnesota and that I knew something about this country too. So it was an interesting episode in my life.
A month or so ago, you and I spent a couple days on the USS Roosevelt, the Big Stick.
Yeah, the Big Stick, yeah.
A nuclear aircraft carrier.
Right.
What did you leave with from that trip?
Well, for me, of course, it was a good experience because I talked to the drivers, the pilots. I spent a lot of time on the carrier. In fact, I just talked to John Osterweil about it. I spent a lot of time talking to the helicopter pilots, which fascinated me. And they said they were tenants on the ship, that they really didn't belong. Also, I'd never been with a full battle group at sea to see a couple of destroyers, a couple of cruisers, the Spanish frigate, and the submarine, a whole group that's going where they're there now, I guess, or they were on their way. It kind of brought back my youth, but I decided that no matter what happens in life, I don't think I want to fly a military airplane anymore. I've been through that. Maybe my courage has softened, but I had no envy for what those guys do. I have tremendous respect for those guys dropping on that deck night and day. It's a tough job.
As you recall, when they were dropping at night, no lights.
Yeah.
And to hit this little 4-acre in the middle of the ocean was unbelievable.
And it's funny, when they fly out, when you're in the air, it really looks like a postage stamp.
Yes.
And, of course, instrumentation is so much more sophisticated now that I also was on the Kennedy in early years, and the instrumentation wasn't quite as sophisticated, and the dropping on the deck was a little more hazardous, I guess, but the experience on the Roosevelt was wonderful, and I'm very indebted to the SEAL and all the troops that brought us out there.
Over 6,000 people on that ship.
And we climbed 8 stories. You forget that.
Well, we climbed 27 stories. and you were right in front of me. You were 87 years old. You were like a 20-year-old.
Yeah, well, that's excitement, I guess. If you're around the military cadre, you have to march. You can't walk away.
Must be the Navy cooking. So, 90% of those kids were under the age of 25, and 30% of them were under the age of 20.
Yeah.
They were amazing. It's 1983, and you found the New York Pops. Can you talk about that?
Well, it had a history, like everything. When Lenny Bernstein had the New York Philharmonic, he and Felicia were good friends of ours. And he'd always talk to me about trying to do, that's the orchestra then was still playing here at Carnegie Hall, where my offices are. And they hadn't moved to Lincoln Center. And he used to talk to me about the possibility of amalgamating players, that he could have an orchestra that could play, it was really to play his music, his theater music, because at that time, you must remember that symphony orchestras played Beethoven, Brahms, Haydn, Mozart beautifully, but they didn't play Bernstein beautifully. It's difficult music, they really didn't play theater music. They didn't have to. And he wanted that very much to be part of the repertoire, and that's why he tried to get me, and I used members of the Philharmonic, and I did a 2-week season here at Carnegie Hall as kind of an audition. And it was one of the superior train wrecks of my life. I booked all my Hollywood friends. I wrote Tyrone Power as a narrator. I mean, there's so many Hollywood people that came on the bill. I didn't realize that movie stars are not box office stars on the stage. It was a bitter lesson to me. But my Frau kept the name New York Pops. She registered it. And we sat with it. And during my music wonderful and headache years at NBC, when I'd guest conduct, there was a gentleman that was at one time manager here. He became the manager here at Carnegie Hall. Cy Rosen was his name. But in earlier years, he'd been executive director or manager of the Pittsburgh Symphony and the Philadelphia Orchestra. When I'd guest conduct there, he'd always tell me, something was wrong. Why don't you do it again? There has to be a place. And then there came a time when John Williams became music director in Boston, and he didn't like the date they did here every year and canceled it. And when he canceled it, Cy called me at home and said, if you can afford it, let's try it once more. And I did a kind of an audition here at Carnegie Hall. We hawked our life, and it was a hell of a night. There wasn't a seat to be had. And about 2 weeks later, Isaac Stern, who is my neighbor up the road in Connecticut, rang me up and said, why don't we try it? And that's really how it began.
If a deaf person could get their hearing for 20 minutes, what few songs would you want them to listen to?
I'd want them to hear the waltzes of Irving Berlin and the symphonies of Mahler. That would be the whole spectrum of my... that would be my total spectrum of life. Maybe a Carmichael song. Oh, I should... Maybe or a song of my ex-roommate Jimmy Van Heusen. But really, waltzes of Berlin and the music of Gustav Mahler.
We're talking to Skitch Henderson. When we come back, we'll ask him what advice he'd give the young musicians, aspiring conductors. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Skitch Henderson. This past July 4th, Skitch was the guest conductor of the Boston Pops on the St. Charles River. Skitch, for the young musicians out there, the aspiring conductors, what would you tell them?
Well, the first thing I would tell them is to study. You can't... I don't think you... you can fake your way maybe up the first two steps of the ladder, but after that, somebody's going to trip you. Conducting is a very evasive profession. I just became a distinguished professor at Western Connecticut University in Connecticut, and one of the courses I'm going to teach ostensibly is conducting. And then when I thought about it, I don't know whether I could teach anything or not, because you could teach, you know, Beecham used to say you can teach an orangutan to beat time. Conducting is a philosophical profession. I think there's so much goes into being a music director or a conductor, so much philosophy. First off, musicians are so much better today. There's so little teaching of, because by the time these ladies and gentlemen come to symphonic orchestras, they are such fantastic players that they really don't need anybody generally to tell them how to finger this or what to do. That era is gone. So it's really a psychological profession, I think. It's how you look, trying to persuade them to maybe bend in the direction that you feel musically. And it's a much broader music spectrum, because all orchestras now have to play all types of modern music, all types of so-called popular music, or light music, as we call it in Britain. I think the profession has changed tremendously in the last 20 years or 25 years. When I grew up, I worked for Toscanini at NBC. I conducted the NBC Symphony in the summertime. And he told me exactly what I could conduct. He told me no French music, only I learned all the barn burner Italian overtures because of him. It was such a stiltified profession at that time, but now it's such a huge, broad house of color that you really better know what you're doing before you put your foot on the stage.
Charles Osgood recently said of you, he's gone from riding the rails as a young runaway to performing in tails as conductor of one of the country's most successful orchestras. And along the way, he managed to hook up with the likes of Arturo Toscanini, Crosby, Sinatra, Garland, Gene Kelly, Johnny Carson. Skitch Henderson always seems to be around where the music's playing, whether it's the Carnegie Hall or at concert halls, parks, and stadiums around the world. You're 87 years old. Where do you get the energy?
Well, I think I love music. I don't love the profession, I have to confess. The union dilemmas, the personalities that I use it advisedly, that you contend with, and I'm not talking about contractors, I'm talking about personnel, because as I said, musicians today are much more independent, as indeed they should be, and lots of that independence can give you a giant headache. But I'm so bloody lucky to do what I do. I really enjoy coming to a rehearsal. I can say that with ecstasy. I don't enjoy the concerts as much, because the best music is generally done at the rehearsal when we're all communicating with each other. And I'm sure your music director of the Detroit Symphony would say the same. Rehearsals are a wonderful way to have togetherness and to enjoy your musical life. But I think the reason that it works for me is because I love music, and I love music of all kinds. I love bluegrass. Flatt and Scruggs were my friends. I loved Isaac Stern. He was my father up the road. And I just think music is a golden wand that can protect you and keep you not only aesthetically, but it keeps your brain working.
For the last 47 years, your partner in life has been Ruth.
Right.
She's actually the president of the New York Pops.
Right.
And with her, you've started the Silo Company,
right,
which is a store, an art gallery, a cooking school in New Milford, Connecticut.
Yeah.
How did all that come about?
We have huge barns. And Ruth always wanted to be, her mother in Germany was a shopkeeper, and her grandmother were shopkeepers, as they said. And she always wanted to have something, and we found an opening on one of the barns where the farmer that had lived there had sold milk, so we could get a license to be a store of some kind. And she started with a friend of ours. They started a little shop. just selling, you know, country trinkets. And then eventually Jacques Papin, the chef who's a friend of ours, talked to her and advised her to start a cooking school there. And it grew. And then from that, she grew into a gallery. And it's not my, I'm the auditioner there, but it's a beautiful, beautiful world. I take care of my tractors, that's all.
Your next few performances.
Well, I go to Tanglewood this weekend on Saturday, and then the week after that, the orchestra, we go to Virginia to open a new art center near the city of Norfolk. And that'll be very interesting because it'll be the first performance in a brand new hall, and we are the auditioners. And I hope they accept us with joy.
What are you proudest of?
Oh, that's a toughie. I suppose I always thought that when I became music director at NBC, that was a dream fulfilled when I sat in North Dakota and used to listen to the radio. But I think my real fulfillment was starting the New York Pops and knowing that it is an institution here in this city and knowing that we're part of the 4th of July with the Federated Stores. We will be every year. We'll be doing the 4th of July. In fact, we have meetings tomorrow to set the schedule for the next 4th.
What are your dreams going forward?
I think my dreams are peace, and I don't mean gunnery peace. I mean internal peace. I think now that I'm starting to teach at a university, I want to back off the podium and having to put on the funny clothes all the time. And I think maybe some of the things that I've stumbled through in my life can be fruition for the young people that I'll be facing, and I hope, you know, their critique will be kind.
We talked about the greatest performer, Chevalier, the greatest American performer, Crosby. Female performers, who would you rate as the highest?
Well, I worked with so many. I did, you know what was unique? I did Kate Smith's, believe it or not. I did her Farewell. She, when she left her career and left New York, she said she wanted to play Carnegie Hall. Now, I had never worked with her in her series, and her Ted Collins, I think, had disappeared from her life, the mentor that she had. And she called me one day at NBC. I was astounded and said, you know, would you come and work with me at Carnegie Hall? And that was an experience for me to watch what I called a giant performer be a nervous wreck on the stage. That made it all come together for me because I'm a nervous soul when I start. Everything is all right when it gets going, but the nerves own me till the downbeat starts.
When you're conducting an audience, if someone's not playing right or whatever, how do you correct them during the middle of a performance?
You don't. You leave things alone, and if you have a common sense, you'll either talk to them, not in front of the troops. I am not that kind of a cop. I talk to them at work. That's why I said rehearsals are so wonderful. I can think of only two or three times in all my years here, 23 years here at Carnegie, that I've said anything to any player afterwards. And then by the time I get around to saying it, I try to cool it so I don't. You can hurt everybody's feelings, and you can destroy friendship sometimes with your mouth. It's very dangerous in our profession, I think.
Skitch, I want to say thanks for coming. You're a true treasure. The enjoyment that you've given the world for decades has been fabulous. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you for your time and effort, and I'll see you on the carrier.
Our guest next Sunday will be Pastor Faith Fowler, the CEO of Cass Community Social Services. Until then, I'm Jack Crisula. Thanks for listening. Make it a great week because anything is possible. Spoken.